Friday evening, 7th June 1974. I think it might be a good thing today if we discussed questions and problems together. Those who are interested, seriously interested in living the religious life, should be well aware of the underlying drive. Why are we interested in religion? What do we understand by religious living? We all have ideas about it. But do those ideas bear correspondence with the truth of the matter? What is the truth of the matter? What is religion itself? What is religiousness? And therefore, what is religious living? But right from the start, let us understand, there are no pat answers. This is religion. Like this is a Chippendale chair or something like that. No such answers at all. I've made a statement like that. Why have I made such a statement? Is there any truth in it? And if it is true, or if it is in line with reality, the reality of our living process and our growing process, then what are the consequences of that with regard to the living of the religious life? Something like this seems to me very necessary. We must really understand. Otherwise, it just becomes another interest, another done thing, another indulgence on a higher plane, so to say. Now, let us consider this together.
It has always concerned me, the great saying of Jesus, before Abraham was, I am. Do you think we could consider that a little, please?
Certainly, let us consider it. Is it the meaning of the statement that you are concerned with?
Yes, it is. The deep meaning of the statement, the implications of the statement.
Well, has anybody any suggestions, anything to contribute there?
Speaks of presence before Abraham was is a different tense and seems to have to do with time more. one feels that Abraham is not a person in a deep sense. What is being spoken of, I don't know.
We could relate this question to the Kabbalah. Probably the greater part of the Christian world, the Orthodox Christian world, would repudiate any tying up of Jesus as the Son of God with the Kabbalah and with Kabbalistic teachings. But as far as I am aware, the fact of the matter is that the Kabbalah is the root of the whole of the Judeo-Christian tradition and teaching. And the original Kabbalah is really identical with the original Veda. Now, one of the modes of expression of fundamental reality as presented in the Kabbalah is in this personalistic form. You know how in Exodus, when Moses is at the burning bush and he asks the Lord God, if the Israelites ask, who hath sent you, what am I to say? And in the English translation, we find, say, I am that I am hath sent you. That is your authority. I am that I am. Now this is the personalistic affirmation of ultimate reality. You find it in the Upanishads, embodied in the word Atma. It is the I am. In the Upanishads you find the other word Brahman also used as being identical in content and meaning with the word Atma. Brahman is the objective term, Atma is the subjective term. If reality, the total reality, were to speak in self-conscious terms, it would just say, I am. Self-affirmation of totality by itself. You find suggestions of that in the Upanishads too. You see? Now, the Kabbalah presents everything very strongly in the personalistic term, in the personalistic manner. Yahweh, the incomprehensible, ultimate deity of whom nothing can be predicated except to say that Yahweh puts out, emanates the mystical no-thing, the mystical nothing, as the starting point of everything. Out of the void, the plenitude emerges into manifestation. You see? Now, the Kabbalistic teaching of this I am existed long before the days of Abraham. Abraham came from the Euphrates-Tigris region. It's a very interesting region in the history of religion of all the peoples existing in the world today, or practically all peoples. And he felt the call to move westwards. Why did he feel that call? He lived amongst the Chaldeans, the Kasdims, as they are called. And the Kasdims had descended into magical practices. And he felt that this was spoiling religion. So he finally said to himself, I'll have nothing to do with this. I'll take the sacred teaching with me. Abraham was a master of the Kabbalah. So he took it with him westwards. You see? So the Kabbalah, this original teaching, which presents reality in terms of the I Am, existed before Abraham, of course. I always read that sentence myself in this way. Before Abraham was I Am. I put the comma after Abraham. Or if you like, you can put it this way. Before Abraham was, the I Am was. The I Am. You see, this is the sort of thing on which one has to meditate very, very deeply. And by meditate, as you know, I do not mean write an essay in imagination or just meander in the mind, musing away, thinking thoughts. The first important stage in meditation is to get free of the thinking process. That means the entire speech process comes to an end. That is the crucial thing about meditation. Then the real meditation starts, pure meditation, the state of being in communion, in which there is no separate, isolative, I-consciousness trying to get into touch with a mind-projected Tao or reality. Otherwise, this is all just a pantomime which goes on in the mind. But there are real potentialities in our own psyche, in our own minds. A real potentiality which is trying to emerge, to come out. This is part of the evolutionary process for us human beings. Evolutionary not merely in the biological or scientific sense, but including every possible potentiality that we have, mental and spiritual. So in order that this potentiality of the mind may come to fruition, we have to get free of the limitations, the shackles of the speech-thought process. Because that process belongs to limitation, to finitude, to time, to beginning and ending, birth, death. It is the sphere of mortality. The prince of this world is lord of that sphere. The lord of death, in other words, is the lord of this sphere. Not meaning the objective world as it is, but the picture of this objective world in my mind, and even more so, the manner in which I am conscious of the objective world. the manner in which I am conscious is the limited thing. This is the basic limitation which all techniques or disciplines of meditation and religious practices and so forth enable you to surmount. You get free of this limitation. And you get free of the limitation by allowing the discursive thought-speech process and the sense functioning to remain calm, perfectly pacified, not repressed, not deliberately, not held down by force, not shut out. Because if you shut out, you have become exclusive. If you want to emerge into the deeper things, all this has to be included into the deeper thing. It is subsumed in it. And this is where the great mistake has been made through the centuries and is being made today by all groups and people who say, come on, you do this, that and the other and you'll get to nirvana in 5.5 years. Oh, that's perfect rubbish. You'll get nowhere. You never will get anywhere. I never will get anywhere. There is an emergence of this transcendent reality through you or through me insofar as I have ceased to resist it. See, it's like that. And so, this which has come down in the great religions of the world from time immemorial, which is embodied in words like I am, Atma, Brahman, God, or Mazda, use the absolute, the infinite, the void, use any term you like, you see. This which has come down is the thing that is trying to emerge out of the depths of individual psyches and transform life, not only for that individual, but for mankind as a whole. Because you and I can never realize or achieve anything but that all mankind is affected. We do not live unto ourselves. We cannot live unto ourselves, even if we tried. It's the nature of reality. It's one total reality. And that's that, so to say. So, before Abraham was the I Am. But meditate on it. And be at one with it. Beware of all the feelings that one gets, which make one imagine that, I am there, I am nowhere. When I am nowhere, the transcendent reality is here and everywhere, but it is shining through here and not shining so much through many other places. You see the difference? Our self-orientation in consciousness is the very devil in us. And this is what we have to look into and see so clearly. When we really see it, that self-orientation vanishes. And your whole life alters accordingly. You may ask, what are the signs by which one may recognize this alteration? Well, consider a simple fact. In my ordinary everyday life, there are stimuli constantly impinging upon me. And only some, of course, reach consciousness. And thank God only some do, otherwise the organism would just burst. Nature has, in her infinite mercy, has so arranged affairs, all the internal mechanics of the organism, that a great sifting and filtering process goes on. So much of the material which comes to us in terms of external stimuli is just rejected as so much buzz, unnecessary, and only the cream of it is presented to consciousness. And even that is hard enough to bear. You see? So that's nature's mercy. Now, when stimuli come to me, and I am conscious of the stimuli, how do I react? Supposing I hear somebody was murdered, brutally murdered, how do I react? Supposing I hear that I have won the pools, how do I react? You see, our immediate, helpless, uninhibited reaction tells us exactly what we are. Are we full of ambition, envy, jealousy, greed, hate, sloppiness, sentimentality, etc., etc.? Everything is revealed by the internal reaction. What does the person who is anxious to achieve do? He tries to repress that which is normally called evil or bad. This is a complete mistake. You can't repress it. Whatsoever comes into the psyche just comes in. For instance, the air in this room is what it is. You can't pick and choose the part of any part of the air which has more oxygen or less carbon dioxide or something. You can't do it. You just it all comes in. And with the psyche, it is still more so. There's nothing to prevent the psychical influences which are moving all over the world from impinging upon you. You can't do it, you see. But if you understand it and maintain inward poise, do not react to it helplessly, but look at it. Look at it clearly, without any judgments, not so much judgments, without passing sentence upon what you see, approving, disapproving, getting attached or getting repelled. Then you'll have right judgment. You will see that this is so and so, that is so and so, this is hateful, this is loving, etc. You'll see the fact as the fact, without any condemnatory judgment or approving judgment, but a judgment which sees the truth of the thing. Then, in that state of inward poise, there is compassion and wisdom functioning in harmony, and that means understanding. Then you understand. Mere intellectual comprehension is not enough, for the very simple reason that mere intellectual comprehension is always held within the framework of fixed values and criteria. But the truth of life just is immensely greater than all our fixed values. Our fixed values are bondages, in fact. So, when this understanding due to true compassion and wisdom is present, then you can make the right response to the stimulus. You will invariably make the right response. It will come naturally, spontaneously, intelligently, not thought out, not a thought out response in accord with a fixed criterion. So you see, this means that this mysterious thing called intelligence within oneself is rarely functioning. Otherwise, it's mere intellectual comprehension, and the intellect, remember, is always the slave of desire. You see? And when only intellectual comprehension is there, there are always flaws in whatsoever one does. But when there's real intelligence, the thing is worked out in its fullness. There is no, as the Buddha would have said, substrate for another conditioned state left over. I use another conditioned state as the translation for jati, which I always say is a truer translation than the usual one of rebirth in the reincarnational sense. There is no substrate for rebirth, the texts will say. No substrate left for another jati is the Pali word. Jati, a conditioned state. Then there is freedom. Otherwise there are these unworked out mental impressions, ideas and so forth, which, as the psychologists put it, sink into the well of the unconscious, and they are continuously operative. In which manner are they operative? Almost always to one's detriment. Even the so-called good impressions. But you take a physical analogy. And I happen to know this from experience only too well. If the books don't get dusted regularly, you know what happens. Not only is there a musty smell and so forth beginning to permeate the room, not only does the paper begin to crumble and the book gets destroyed and so forth, but when you handle it and it goes into your breath and you begin to get trouble with your throat and your chest and whatnot. You see, what has remained in the well is a source of dis-ease. And this is what happens with the so-called well of the unconscious. Leave it in the unconscious, turn your face away from it, try and forget it, because it's too painful to look at or too unpleasant to bring to mind. And all right, it will become a stronger and a stronger devil, fed by yours truly, myself. You see, you can't neglect anything. Everything has to be fully attended to, and the right response must be forthcoming. The I am. What a tremendous statement. Ehiye asher ehiye. It's the original Hebrew. I am that I am. Oh, this is a tremendous subject. A very fascinating subject. You know, in the Kabbalistic teaching and in the whole Judaic presentation, that is to say the inner teachings, not just the outer form of it, which is very misleading. Yahweh is first presented as He. The next stage is you. The next stage is I. That's the final affirmation. Now, what does all this mean? Does it mean that there is an entity, Yahweh, somewhere in space and time, which at first is a he, then becomes a you, and then becomes an I? It's absurd, isn't it? This is the way in which they attempted to convey the fact that I, the human being, becoming aware of innermost reality, become aware of it first as the objective, away from me, he. When he and I are introduced to each other and get on a few friendly terms, I have the cheek to say you to Yahweh. But when the friendly terms have undergone their full process of development and culminated in perfect communion, there is no he, there is no you, there is I. You can put it the other way around too. You have it in Islamic mysticism particularly, Sufism and so forth. The devotee visited, knocked at the door of God's abode, and the voice within said, "Who is it?" "It's me." "What do you want?" "I want to come in." And the voice said, "Oh no, you're not fit, go away." So after much tribulation, knocked again. "Who is it?" "Thou, O Lord." "Come in." You see, what charming forms the deep truths have taken. But we have to understand them, not get carried away by the poetry of the thing. This is one of the difficulties. When you write of the deep things in beautiful language, a person gets intoxicated with the beauty of the language and the inner reality is lost. So, the I am, that is the form there. You can say, "Thou art," and stop, make that include the whole thing. Or, "He is," or "It is." The Upanishads chose "It is." At least so most of the scholars will say. But this is neither an it or a he. It is suprapersonal, because personality cannot be denied. It cannot be cut out. But separate personality is what has to be transcended. And you and I can do it in consciousness alone. Obviously we can't do it bodily. We can't have bodily communion with totality. Impossible. But in mind and consciousness, meaning the manner in which we are aware of totality, this is the crux of the thing. The manner in which we are aware. If the religiousness in us has come to fruition and we live in the state of communion, then the manner in which we are aware of this totality is the very reverse of the manner in which we are aware of the world in our ordinary state. In our ordinary state, it's the world and I. The not-self, the self. But look how absurd that is. This tiny little infinitesimal speck in the cosmos is one party to the relationship, and the total cosmos is merely another party to it. I must be a marvelous fellow, mustn't I? Lord, what a fool I am. But having seen what a fool I am, then there is a change. One gets transformed into the pure fool, Parsifal. It's the meaning of Parsifal, the pure fool. You see? And how is he purified of his folly? By infinite suffering and compassion. When we have taken the suffering of the whole world into ourselves, including our own suffering, And just let it get transformed within our own consciousness. We have drunk the world's poisoned cup of sorrow to the dregs. And then there is the manifestation of immortality through the one who has done it. I never become immortal. You'll never become immortal. But immortality is a word designating the manner in which you are aware of totality. The self-orientation is completely out. And this is the difference. This is the absolute reversal of the worldly condition. See, these are the things we must really meditate on, get into communion with, in the quiet. Let the mind just quietly dwell upon. Dwell upon the fact that oneself is self-oriented. At first there will be a very considerable discursive process, inevitably. There's no escape from that. We will talk silently in our minds. Then a peculiar change begins to take place. The talking dies down, but the awareness intensifies. It's impossible to explain in words the awareness which is speechless, which is thought-free. No thoughts are there. No feelings are there, in our ordinary sense of the word feelings. There are no perceptions in the perceiving subject seeing or perceiving the observed object. That is all out. But you are fully awake. This is the crux of it. You are awake. And the impossible happens. That which happens in sleep, in deep slumber, happens when you're awake. Now, what are its implications? Work that out. But don't work them out merely intellectually and logically. Let the mind be perfectly quiet and feel out into this thing, into this reality. Don't attempt to feel out. Don't behave like an amoeba throwing out a pseudopod in order to grab the thing that it needs for its food. No, just feel it out. Let it happen. And it may happen, or it may not.
What do you understand by in the beginning was the word? And does it relate to meditation? And if so, how?
Very good question. The Greek word is logos. In the beginning was the logos. And it is translated as word. The word logos is also used in relation with the ultimate creative power of the universe. You have, for instance, in Genesis, in the very first chapter, "And Elohim said, let there be, and there was," whatever he wanted to be, you see. Now, take the word man, our ordinary word man, which is derived from the Sanskrit root man. The root sound is man, and the verb is manyate, which is usually translated as to think. You and I, in the ordinary way, and people all over the world, translate the word thinking as a process which goes on in the mind, as we say, a logical process. Sometimes it is illogical, and so forth. Now notice logical and illogical in this context. Words. Our words are intended to, and they do considerably, express the idea, the concept. So, underlying the word, or shall we say associated with the word, especially the word which is spoken aloud or written down, is the conception. Now, the ancients, in trying to present some sort of explanation of the uprising of the whole world, postulated this ultimate divine being or this ultimate creative power, if they were scientific-minded and impersonal-minded rather than personal-minded. So this creative power or this divine being had a conception. If, for instance, in the first chapter of Genesis it were said, "And Elohim," Elohim is the word used which is translated as God, "and Elohim minded, and there was," what are the implications of that? What is meant by the mind of Elohim? We know what we mean by mind, or do we? We use this word mind throughout our lives and we haven't the vaguest idea what on earth mind means. I suggest we can look at mind as a receptive, responsive, hyphenate the two words, a receptive, responsive sensitivity characterizing the living organism, the human organism. This receptive, responsive sensitivity. This is what we mean by mind, we could mean by mind in connection with ourselves. And it expresses itself always in speech. There is nothing you can think devoid of speech. People say, "Oh, but I think in pictures." Yes, but you know what the pictures are. How do you know them? Except by naming them. So the name is a word. You will always come down to speech. This speech faculty is the most remarkable thing which we have as compared with all other animal species. It's our most extraordinary faculty. It's a synthesizing faculty. It synthesizes all our sense impressions. You see? All right. So there is the conception that is in the mind of God, as we say. When we talk like this, obviously we are talking analogically. We are going from ourselves, the limited, the ignorant creature, to the unlimited, the postulated, omniscient, divine being. And we say that the divine being has a mind and he has a conception. The conception in the mind of God is the meaning of Logos. The ultimate meaning of Logos we can get insofar as words and thoughts are concerned. Human words and thoughts are concerned. So in the beginning was the conception. And the very interesting part of it is, and the conception was in God, and the conception was God. If you look at the Hellenistic presentation of the teachings, the Egyptian teachings, the of Hermes Trismegistus, the Trismegistic writings, you see, you will find something very wonderful presented there. The disciple is in a deep state of meditation. People usually say he was in a trance, and his teacher reveals to him the origins of things, you see, and refers to the originating source, the Father God, as mind. It's most fascinating that that word mind is used in these Trismegistic writings, which puts it into direct relationship with the Buddhistic presentation. The Buddhistic presentation always talks of mind as ultimate. You see? All right. And God, God the mind, made, having made this, that, and the other, made man in his own image, with whom he fell in love because he was so beautiful, and made him co-equal to himself. Now, there is the secret. In those days, and considering the people amongst whom one lived, if anybody dared to say, "I am God," well, you know what would happen. You'd soon be out of this world. I cannot say you'd be in another world, because you has a meaning only in this world. It has no meaning elsewhere. You see? So they had to put it in these forms. And for the very wise one, the capable one, he awoke to the realization that what is being spoken of is the transformation in my own consciousness, in my own mode of awareness. See? So now, man, to think, really means to create. And this creative this creative power is identical with creation itself. You and I don't know anything about it, and never can know, in our sense of the word, know anything about it. Never can. Absolutely useless. We may produce philosophical system after philosophical system, and it all goes the way of the dust. Some other philosopher arises and says, "Oh no, no, but his basic assumptions are false," and he presents the proof that they are false. And so on and so on and so on. It's useless. It's the transformation of awareness which matters, and then you can't talk about it afterwards. So, in the beginning was the Word. That's how it is put. The conception. But these are all poor ways, really, of talking. When one somehow does realize something within oneself, then one sees that the whole edifice of teachings, of writings, of talking, of trying to impart to other people truth or something, the whole thing is nonsense. Your life and my life doesn't subsist by virtue of you or I doing or willing anything at all. I'm alive, that's that. It's a mystery. Inexplicable mystery. I can put an end to this biological life manifest here. the cells of the body will just suddenly cease to be self-motivated, to be self-reproductive, and to be self-healing. These are the three outstanding characteristics of the cell. It'll cease to be that. Just suddenly. What? How? Goodness knows. There is a bridge, there is a gap in our knowledge. Like so many gaps. In fact, most of us are all gaps and no knowledge. Like the atom, which has vast spaces between the nucleus and the electrons. It's an emptiness. It's very significant, you know. Because it's the almost disheartening and terrifying thing about the study of the scriptures. We can fruitfully study, read the scriptures, fruitfully read the scriptures, only when we are beyond the need of reading the scriptures. When we are it, then, oh, of course, it's all simple. Simple, my dear Watson. It's just like that. Your great pianist who has become absolute master of the piano, effortless playing. He doesn't have to strive to make music and to play and to see that the notes are correct and the expression is right and all the rest of it. It just happens naturally. And it is like that with us. Then he looks at a score of music and he just knows what's what. Whereas if I looked at the score, then only when I play it or hear it played, I might begin to have some real knowledge of what it sounds like. You have to be it. And something still more beyond all that. Whilst being, you have also to realize how to unbe it. Whilst you are alive, this is the triumph over death, the supreme triumph. To realize the state of awareness which is non-being, although you are in being, just as I said some time back, that what ordinarily you experience in deep slumber, you experience in full waking consciousness. You're not asleep. See, this is the sort of thing that makes your critical intellectual say, oh, what absolute tosh the man's talking. Airy-fairy nonsense. It's a strange thing that the hard-headed intellectuals throughout the ages, if they had only lived a few hundred years, assuming that their mental faculties remained intact, would undergo terrible suffering to discover that what they thought was logical and truthful is now regarded as airy-fairy nonsense. I'll give you a simple example. When the atomic theory was first postulated by speculative philosophy, look at the things they said. Today we have the atomic theory, as we call it, and the knowledge of atoms and so forth, and we sort of smile very benevolently at what Democritus and Leucippus in Greece and Kanada and Kapila in India, I forget the Chinese philosophers who talked about the atomic theories, they also had their atomic theories slightly prior to the Greeks, about a century or so. And there we are. This is what we have come to. It would be a very useful exercise till we meet again if you feel like it. Meditate. Just let the mind get quite quiet and the sense impressions and speech process become pacified. Let it get pacified and then feel out what draws me to religion. What do I understand by living religiously? Or is it in actual fact for me only transcendental alcoholism? Why do I practice transcendental meditation? Why do I go to this society, to that group, to this man, etc.? Why? You've heard that teaching of the Buddha times out of number. And he speaks to his beloved disciple Ananda. Ananda, the cessation of all grasping is indeed nirvana, is deathlessness. The cessation of all grasping. And grasping takes place not merely physically, by one's hands or by one's skills or by juggling finances so that you make a lot of money or grasp or get something. It takes place in the mind all the time. We are conscious all the day long in terms of grasping and getting. We are unconsciously that. You watch yourselves. It's very difficult to watch because we get caught up in the process, the thing that has to be done at once. And the thing that has to be done at once is being done in the way which is conditioned, completely conditioned, by our own nature and our own qualities throughout the years. And how are we conditioned? To grasp for ourselves, to gain something, to achieve something, to attain something. Who achieves, grasps, gains, attains? I. This postulated I. So you see, this root selfishness is absolute lord and master of us all the time. That is why it is so difficult. That's why the journey is long and arduous. Very long, very arduous. But don't grasp in the mind. Cease to grasp altogether. Then the senses get purified. When they are non-grasping, they are no longer tainted and they are no longer bound. And there is freedom in every respect.